Well, good evening, my dearly loved brethren and sisters and young people. We left Jacob in the midst of the ordinary domestic circumstances of his family life. One day meeting a test that he was not really ready for. It's one of those circumstances that we often and continually will find ourselves in. But unfortunately, on that day when his father announced that he felt he was going to die, that led to all the train of events that occurred that brought about the passing of the blessing and the deception that was involved in that day. Tragically, Jacob hearkened to the voice of the Syrian from within his mother and from within himself. And that voice overpowered the voice of conscience in him about what was right. And it led inevitably to sin, to deception, and on from there, as sin always is wont to do, to fear and uncertainty. And that's where we pick him up tonight. You know, despite the circumstances that happened in that house on that day, and as we know, that is just a one day's snapshot in that family's life. Not a high day, but there for us to learn. It's not for us to judge them, it's for us to learn from them. Because God used on that occasion the hands of Esau to bring about his will. It didn't matter what the circumstances were, whether they were initiated by Jacob or not, God was still able to use them. Because Jacob had set his mind and his heart to seek the God of his father Abraham from a very early age, and God was determined to complete that work that he'd begun. Well, the consequences of the circumstances of that day were that Esau was obviously enraged. The end of chapter 27 tells us about that. Esau was absolutely enraged, that is, after he'd pleaded with his father for a blessing and his father Isaac had said no. And Rebekah, as a result of the rage of Esau, panicked. And so, again, the voice of the Syrian comes out again. Verse 43 of that chapter previous to the one we've just read in chapter 27. "Now therefore, my son, obey my voice and arise and flee thou to Laban, my brother, to Haran. And tarry with him a few days until thy brother's fury be turned away." So she's again immediately scheming because of the urgency of the circumstances. And it's very understandable, isn't it, brothers and sisters, when things like that actually happen to us. The urgency presses upon us and we want to react, to work out immediately what we need to do instead of just stopping quietly and putting everything in the hands of God and then moving forward in faith. Well, we find that as a result of this panic, Isaac is called in and he eventually sends Jacob off to spend a few days, as it was originally planned, with Laban. A few days that turned into many, many years, as we know, of difficulty and hardship. And there Jacob, in that experience, was to learn to hate the Syrian characteristics that he couldn't see in his mother and he couldn't see in himself. So by the hand of God, God had moved him into a different circumstance in order to perfect him for a work that was yet to come. So we pick up the story now in chapter 28 tonight as Isaac calls Jacob finally in verse 1 here. And what we've just read here in terms of what Isaac says to Jacob is a tremendous testimony to the faith of this man. You know, Paul in Hebrews 11, we won't turn to it now, we alluded to it the other day. We know that Paul there says that Isaac, by faith, blessed his sons concerning things to come. Now, we know that he was deceived, and thinking he was blessing Esau, he actually laid that blessing on Jacob. But having realized in the middle of all that, as when Esau came in, the folly of what he'd done, he immediately turned track, and his conviction and his determination returned to him. It's as if just a blind was pulled up and once again he could see spiritually again. For a moment, blinded by all that Esau meant to him, which, you know, we find difficult perhaps to even understand. But now what he says to Jacob highlights not only his former folly, but the greatness of the faith of this man. Because we find there's no blame and no rebuke towards Rebekah or towards Jacob in all of this following that event. And now Isaac has got it completely straight, because he talks about, at the end of verse 5, for example, the record tells us, because it's getting it straight here, that he was sent away Jacob to Padan Aram, to Laban, the son of Bethuel the Syrian, the brother of Rebekah, Jacob and Esau's mother. Jacob and Esau's mother. They're put around the right way now in the record. It's not as if they are there by order of birth, but now by order of the God-promised sequence. And so verse 1 tells us here, "And Isaac called Jacob and blessed him and charged him and said unto him, Thou shalt not take a wife of the daughters of Canaan. Arise, go to Padan Aram, to the house of Bethuel, thy mother's father, and take thee a wife from thence of the daughters of Laban, thy mother's brother." He blessed him. Now we know that he'd already given a blessing, but now he's going to add another blessing, which was very different. A blessing that he could never, even in his most blind state, could never ever have given to Esau. But he now is prepared to lay upon the shoulders of Jacob and upon his head the blessing of the Abrahamic covenant. But you know, it's interesting there, brothers and sisters, it just doesn't say that there's a blessing coming here, because verses 3 and 4 we read about that blessing. But it says he blessed him and charged him. You know, there are always responsibilities that come with blessing. Whenever the blessing of God comes, brothers and sisters, there is inevitably responsibilities. There is a charge that comes with it. And it doesn't matter in what form we ever read the blessings of God, there is inevitably the full weight of a responsibility that we have before God. And here, it's no different, because Isaac's about to lay the full Abrahamic blessing on this man. But he also sternly charges him. And look at what the charge was. Don't marry a Canaanite woman. That was the charge. Don't marry a Canaanite woman. That was the additional responsibility, the outworking of the covenant to Abraham. Now, that's an amazing thing, isn't it? Why did he choose that? Well, for a start, you know, look at where Esau is. Esau's already married three Canaanites, Hittite women. So he's put himself, if this is the responsibility that goes with the Abrahamic covenant, he's already put himself outside that. But you know, when Israel got into the land later, then the descendants of Jacob, and as the tribes of Israel came into Sinai and they were going to go eventually through into the promised land, the thing that God repeated over and over and over again was, when you get into the land, don't marry the Canaanites, because this is such a critical thing, you will lose the covenant. That was the point. They would lose the truth, because if they were to intermarry with the Canaanites, the Canaanites would lead them astray, it would grab their hearts and take them away from God. And eventually, they would lose the hope that had been laid down to Abraham, Isaac and Jacob. And here, Isaac saw that issue so clearly, right back here. And so at this very time when Jacob is to leave the household, the one thing he wants to, above all other things, lay upon him is the significance of not actually marrying those who God said were cursed. And so, verse 2, the plan, which was essentially Rebekah's plan, which Isaac now discusses with Jacob, it says, "Rise, go to Padan Aram, to the house of Bethuel, thy mother's father, and take a wife from thence of the daughters of Laban, thy mother's brother." Now, notice here this emphasis again on their connection back to the Syrian family, the connection of his mother's father and his mother's brother. And then verse 5 again, to Laban the son of Bethuel, the Syrian, the brother of Rebekah. You see, in the context of all this, this story about the voice of the Syrian hasn't left us. And God is showing that he's going to work through all of this to perfect Jacob in the end. It was a circumstance that Jacob was going to be taken into, and he went there with some sort of sense of excitement, perhaps a little apprehension, but he didn't ever expect to find what transpired there. But God, in his wisdom, and through the means of the circumstances that he had orchestrated, was going to allow Jacob to be in an environment where he could confront the real issue of the Syrian within him. Now, Jacob cooperated completely with Isaac here, and the reason he did is not just because he was afraid of Esau, though he probably was. We know, because the record tells us a little later, that he was afraid and he was fleeing from Esau at the time. But I don't think that's the reason that he cooperated so willingly here. I think the reason is that he understood what Jacob was saying. He understood that there was a responsibility that came with the Abrahamic covenant, and that's the one thing that was at the center of his thinking. He wanted above all other things to be in harmony with God and to gain those promises and the blessing that had come from Abraham through to Isaac, and now he wanted to be the recipient of all that. And he was quite happy to accept that he wasn't to marry a Canaanite and that he was going to go off to the family in a far off distant place and there to find a wife. Well, then Isaac lays upon Jacob the Abrahamic blessing. Verse 3, "And God Almighty, El Shaddai, bless thee and make thee fruitful and multiply thee, that thou mayest be a multitude of people, and give thee the blessing of Abraham to thee and to thy seed with thee, that thou mayest inherit the land wherein thou art a stranger, which God gave unto Abraham." You know, that must have been just so thrilling to Jacob to hear that, and a point of great bonding as far as Isaac was concerned too, because really he really did understand that Jacob was the spiritual of those two boys. And he had seen him grow up as an upright and godly man that had loved the promises and that was prepared to be a tent dweller. To this man, Jacob, this was all that he ever wanted. He didn't seek for anything else but to gain the Abrahamic covenant. And now he hears those words. Notice now that we've got the mention of the seed, we've got a mention of God Almighty, of the blessing of the land and so on. All the essential elements of the Abrahamic covenant are now coming out in these words. And none of that appeared when Isaac spoke to Esau in the previous chapter, because even Isaac was unable to mouth those words. And so he says that he's laying this blessing of multiplicity, that there may be a multitude of people. In fact, interesting that word multitude there in the Septuagint is actually ecclesia. "I may become an ecclesia of people and give thee the blessing of Abraham to thee," and so on. Now, this little phrase there, we're not going to spend a lot of time on this tonight, brothers and sisters, but it's just interesting in passing. This little phrase in verse 4, that he give thee the blessing of Abraham. The blessing of Abraham. "To thee," he says, "and to thy seed with thee." You know, Esau couldn't ever have comprehended what that meant. He didn't understand what the blessing of Abraham was. But it's the very thing that Jacob wanted. It's the heart of what he was looking for. And the reason for him, almost the reason for him existing and for living. Because to him, those great blessings which had come through to his grandfather were the core of his spiritual life. But what was that blessing, brothers and sisters? It wasn't just the fruitfulness that's mentioned in verse 3. It's not just multitude of people, a large nation, and even nations of nations coming from them. Even an ecclesia of people that was going to go outside the borders of blood relationships. It wasn't just that. It wasn't even just the land. The true blessing of Abraham, as we know, being interpreted from the New Testament, was the forgiveness of sins. Now, here, Isaac actually seems to understand that, because if you read carefully, it says, to give thee, verse 4, the blessing of Abraham to thee and to thy seed with thee. So that phrase with thee is very similar to the other phrases that we find often in the promises to Abraham, but more particularly in the promise to David, where David is said that the king shall reign in his presence. So here, this blessing was going to involve not only him, but his seed to come, and he would be there at the time. Now, the clear implication of that is that there had to be an extension of life. And an extension of life that goes so far, knowing mortality, it meant resurrection had to be a condition. And if a person was going to be resurrected and given life, brothers and sisters, it required that a person be forgiven. You know, if God says that the wages of sin is death, God just can't willy-nilly just raise anyone and give them life again. It's totally against his principles, unless there is some foundation that's already been established upon which that can happen. And that foundation upon which it can happen is forgiveness of sin. You know, that's what Paul says in Galatians. And we've read this many, many times, but just look carefully at what he's saying. And the scripture foreseeing that God would justify the nations through faith preached before the gospel unto Abraham, saying, in thee shall all nations be blessed. So here's the blessing. So then, they which be of faith are blessed with faithful Abraham. So the blessing is something that comes by faith. It's not just something that's handed down. It is, faith is an integral part of the blessing. And Paul tells us quite clearly, God, seeing that he would justify the heathen by faith, that is, that he would make righteous, that he would forgive people their sins, if you don't want to put that in another way, preached the gospel and said, I'm going to bless people through Abraham. So that's the blessing, unquestionably. But we wonder whether the patriarchs really understood the significance of that. Because here Paul in Galatians has to open that up, open the Old Testament, explain that that was actually the center of the gospel. Now, did the patriarchs really understand that? Well, you know, brothers and sisters, you'd have to ask ourselves a question. You know, this is the greatest blessing that God could ever give anyone. And that's not just an exaggeration. It has to be the greatest blessing. Upon this blessing, every other blessing is subordinate and rests. Because unless God is able to deal for us with the issue of sin in our lives, which has blighted every one of us, and which by his law will put us in the grave forever, what is the use of any other blessing if that condition still exists? There is no reason at all to want anything else if God is going to maintain his position that sin brings death and there's no way around that. So the greatest thing that God could ever do for a man or woman is to offer forgiveness of sin. The greatest blessing. Now, do you think that Isaac and Jacob did not understand that? Did they not understand the implications of what that blessing was to Abraham? I ask you why they wandered for all their lives through a desert living in tents. Why did they do it if they just thought that one day they were going to get a piece of land? Or one day they were going to have a multitude of descendants whom they would never see? It doesn't make sense, brothers and sisters. So it seems even from the surface that they did understand. But you know, Peter actually goes, well, I was going to say a little further. Perhaps he doesn't go a little further. He actually comes at this a different way around. I think you've noticed in Acts 3, the end of Acts 3, when Peter is giving his speech, he says, "And ye are the children of the prophets, and of the covenant which God made with our fathers, saying unto Abraham, and in thy seed shall all kings of the earth be blessed." So he's just told the Jews there in the temple that the blessing of God is coming through Abraham. Right? Then he says, "Unto you first, God, having raised up his son Jesus, sent him to bless you, in turning away every one of you from his iniquities." What is the difference in what Peter said and what Paul said? There is a difference there. Even though they're inherently the same, there's a difference. What's the difference between that? God would justify the heathen through faith. And he sent Jesus to bless you in turning every one of you away from his iniquities. Anyone want to hazard a guess? No, it's not even a guess. Yes. Even though it's not written like that, isn't it? Certainly it's true. It's one thing that God's going to do and one thing that we're going to do. But just think about what Peter is saying here. He's saying God is still actually going to achieve this last one, what Peter said. God is going to turn us away from our iniquities. Now, that is a precursor to the forgiveness of sins, is it not? So Peter and Paul are not at odds here. Because before a man can be forgiven of his sins, he's got to acknowledge them and turn and want to receive and find repentance and turn back to God. But that's what Peter's talking about here. He's saying that the blessing is that God will actually turn you away from your sins. You know, that is an amazingly difficult thing. You know, we think that God is all-powerful. You know, there's one thing that stops God from doing anything he likes. Only one thing in the whole of the universe that stops God from doing what he wants. And that's the human free will. We can prevent God from doing what he wants because we know that it's not his will that any should perish, but an individual human heart can become so stubborn that it refuses to bow, refuses to acknowledge him, refuses to turn away from its iniquity, and God cannot forgive, even though he wants to. So human will, human free will can get in the way of what God wants to do. Of course, it won't frustrate his ultimate purpose. God's ultimate purpose will still happen despite human failing. And whatever happens, God will still be honoured and his will still be achieved. But the amazing thing about Peter's statement is that he said the blessing of the Abrahamic covenant was God actually working in our lives to get us to the point where we would want to turn away from our iniquities and come to God and then receive forgiveness of sins and to receive that justification by faith. And God is able even to do that, brethren. This is an amazing thing. He will work even with our free will. He will work to organize circumstances in our life so that we come to understand and appreciate our own sinfulness and want to turn back to him. You know, I think the patriarchs actually understood the significance of that. Because we read in the rest of verse 4 there, that thou mayest, second half of verse 4, thou mayest inherit the land wherein thou art a stranger, which God gave unto Abraham. And that seems as though it's just talking about the inheritance of the land. But did you notice too that it calls him a stranger, wherein thou art a stranger? You know, that's not without significance, because that's saying that Jacob, you are a godly man, a man of faith, because you wouldn't be a stranger unless you were. And you are the true heir, not Esau, you are the true heir. You know, and time again from this point on, we find Jacob's thinking and his decisions that are just dominated by this eternal promise. And at the end of his life, Jacob enunciated this. He said something that God hadn't actually said in as many words. Because there, it says in verse 3, Jacob said unto Joseph, God Almighty appeared unto me at Luz in the land of Canaan and blessed me and said unto me, Behold, I make thee fruitful and multiply thee. I will make thee fruitful and multiply thee, and I will make of thee a multitude of people, all the aspects of the Abrahamic covenant, and will give thee this land to thy seed after thee for an everlasting possession. Now, you know, God never actually said those words. They're not actually recorded in the Genesis record at the time that he was at Bethel. In that form, they're not recorded like that. That last phrase is an interpretation by Jacob about what God meant. And he saw that this promise of all the inheritance of all these blessings was an everlasting blessing. That is, if he was going to inherit the land, it was forever. And he understood the implications of that. That it meant that he had to be raised, that there had to be forgiveness of sins, and that God was able to work to bring that all about. And it was those things, brethren, it was that eternal nature of these promises that drove Jacob all his life. Despite the fact that we find on occasions his weakness just appearing through the record. But God's actually deliberately penned his life, showing us this little streak through his life that was the thing he had to contend with, just like we have to contend with the flesh. It's not as if his life was just orchestrated by sin all the way through. It wasn't at all. He was an amazingly godly man. And so we find him getting to the point of leaving, after having had the blessing, the Abrahamic blessing, laid upon him. And we're going to move to verse 10. And Jacob went out from Beersheba and went toward Haran. It's a very interesting little verse, because Beersheba means the well of the oath. That had been, for Jacob, his home for most of his life. It was the place where there was comfort, because the truth was loved there, and he learned to love it. First in the company of his mother and father, but also in the company of Abraham for some time, the first 15 years of his life. Excuse me, because Abraham had dwelt there and with the family for some time, until he finally died. But he's going to leave that, the well of the oath, where the living water that was connected to the covenant was. He's now going to leave that and go to Haran. Haran means dry and arid. I mean, it's really quite a contrast, isn't it? And it was going to be dry and arid in more than one sense. Not only was it going to be a dry and arid place, literally out in Syria, because as Jacob himself was later to say, the sun smote him by day and the frost by night. It was a very inhospitable place. It wasn't a comfortable place at all. And yet that really wasn't even the most significant dryness and aridness, because out there he was going to find very few people who had any interest in divine and eternal things. Well, he was to just embark here. It just says in so many words there, he left Beersheba and went toward Haran. That's a journey of 1,400 kilometres. That's a massive journey to just leave. And he leaves, as we find later, with nothing but his staff in his hand. Nothing. He just left because Esau is so angry. This whole thing was orchestrated so quickly. And he's out the door, off on a 1,400-kilometer journey. And really not knowing quite where he's going. Or so we would think. Well, he heads off. And we find he comes to Bethel. We're not told that straight away, but we find that he comes to Bethel. Now, if you have a look at this, here's Beersheba right at the bottom of the map. Now, can I find that little pointer? And can I find the laser? Yeah, Beersheba's down here. Notice where it is. It's actually just in the bottom of the foothills. This is the low plains, just rising slightly, that comes up into the hill country of Judea up here. So it rises fairly steep up here. And this is where he must have gone, up through here. There's a track up through Hebron and across and eventually up past Jerusalem and up to the region of Luz or Bethel, and which you'll notice is still in the Judean mountains. So he had to go from what was not very high above sea level to something like about 3,000 feet above sea level. It's considerably higher than Mount Lofty.
this climb that he went up here. Now,
in actual fact, if you were going to Haran, you would never have gone that way.
If you lived in Beersheba, you would have taken this road out here and caught what was a major trade route up the coast. For a start, it would have been easy work, flat roads all the way up there,
crossed in across either the plain of Esdraelon or even further and then crossed across through Galilee and then up into Syria that way. And along the what was the trade route known as the Way of the Sea. But he didn't go that way. We find him in Bethel. So he's gone straight. Is that because he didn't know where he was going? I don't think so, because if we read on, it says in verse 11, "And he lightened upon a certain place and tarried there all night because the sun was set. And he took of the stones of that place and put them for his pillows and lay down in that place to sleep." Now, excuse me, the authorized version is not really very clear. Or not as clear as it could be, because this phrase that's connected to this certain place here, it's this phrase, a certain place, is in the Hebrew, the place. The place. He lighted upon the place. And a little further on, he took of the stones of the place. Not that place. The place. And he lay down in the place to sleep. So three times we find this phrase, the place. There is something special here. There is some reason that he's come there. And I think there's no doubt that he had deliberately chosen to go up through the highlands because he was looking for the place, whatever the place here was. I believe when he arrives there, and it seems as though he found it, there are stones there that are specifically mentioned that he takes and he lays down for one of those for pillows, and then he sets up another one and anoints it a little later on. I think what Jacob was doing was looking for the place, the altar where Abraham had set up many, many years before, just to the east of that on a mountain, because we find that that's exactly what Abraham had done. In that region of Bethel, Abraham had set up an altar. But why would he actually come here? Well, go back a few pages in Genesis to chapter 12. And perhaps this gives us a clue. Genesis 12. Did you know that Bethel was the first place that Abraham pitched a tent? That begs the question, what did he live in before that? I don't actually think it was the first place he pitched his tent. I think he had a tent long before that. But look at verse 8. "And he removed from thence." Where's the thence? He was in Shechem. Okay, if you read back, verse 6. "He came to Shechem." The Canaanite was in the land, right? He built an altar there. "And he removed," verse 8, "from thence unto a mountain on the east of Bethel, and pitched his tent, having Bethel on the west and Hai on the east, and there he builded an altar unto Yahweh and called upon the name of Yahweh." So that's actually the first time we find Abraham recorded time of him pitching his tent. Now, he must have stayed in something when he was at Shechem and prior to that, but it's the first time it tells us that he pitched his tent. You know, what Abraham did is he came into the land from Ur, from Haran, came down into the land, and the first stop we know of in the land is at Shechem. Now, Shechem in the scriptures is almost always painted as a place of decision. There were so many decisions that actually took place, and the people even later were called back to that point to make decisions. Joshua called them back there. Moses called them back there and read the blessings and cursings, and Joshua said, "Now today you've got to make a decision here." So that's just an example, but there are many other places in Scripture where Shechem is a place, is a point of decision. And here it starts here with Abraham, who comes into the land and he makes a decision. He sees the Canaanite in the land, it tells us, and he's going to make a decision to stay. And it says he goes down and pitches his tent near Bethel. The decision he made is he's going to stay, And now he's pitching his tent. And that is telling us that he's prepared to accept a pilgrim life. Because we know that Paul later takes up the idea of tent dwelling as being an evidence that the patriarchs had the faith to live a simple life and not to seek all the stuff that they had before. So it represented the tent being pitched here, represented his acceptance of God's way in faith, and now he's a sojourner. That's Abraham. Okay? Then we know that everything went wrong. There was a famine in the land, and Abraham went down into the land of Egypt because there was no food and water, and he went down to that region. We know that everything went wrong down there. And so finally, after that whole mess is all untangled, he comes back up to the land. But where did he go? Chapter 13 and verse 1. And Abram went up out of Egypt, he and his wife and all that he had, Lot with him, into the south. And Abram was very rich in cattle and silver and gold. And he went on his journeys from the south, even to Bethel, unto the place where his tent had been at the beginning, between Bethel and Ai, under the place of the altar which he'd made there, the first. Now, that is not the first altar he made, and it's probably not the first place he pitched a tent, but it was the first symbolic place at which he had committed to being a pilgrim. Committed to being a pilgrim. Having travelled all that way across there, now he's committed to being a pilgrim. There he built an altar and called upon the name of Yahweh at that very moment of time. And I think what Jacob is doing here is trying to go back and find the roots that Abraham, he's trying to go back and rediscover what Abraham had found. Well, it was probably going to be nothing really magical in the place, but he wanted to go and relive that. He wanted to find, now that he'd left home and was forced out, he was going to try and find the inspiration. The very last thing as he walked out the door that had just happened was that upon his head had been laid the mighty blessings of Abraham. And now he wanted to walk in Abraham's footsteps. So he goes right back to Bethel, to the very first place that Abraham had pitched his tent and then committed his life to God. Wow. Do you think, brethren and sisters, that if Abraham, as an old man, had had the opportunity to have little Jacob on his knee until the age that he became a teenager, in fact, until he was about 15 years of age, do you think that Abraham had never, ever told Jacob about the experiences of coming into Shechem, going to Bethel, going down to Egypt and the folly of doing that, and then coming back and how he found the point again and he reestablished that altar and he pitched his tent there? Do you think he never told him any of that? Of course he would have. He's a man of faith that was motivated, the driving force of that family for years to come. And he passed that on from generation to generation. And we know from Hebrews 11 that Jacob had the same faith as Abraham, dwelling in tents. So now Jacob's off on this journey. This journey that's going to take him 85 kilometres as the crow flies. It would have been longer than that by road up through this region to the region of Bethel. At best, it would have he could have got there in 2 days, perhaps if he'd had Esau chasing him, as we know was the case, he would have been going as fast as he could. Because in his mind, certainly he's conscious of Esau behind him, and he left with nothing, and he's just going as fast as he can. But what's going through his mind? He's apprehensive about the future. He doesn't know what lays ahead. He doesn't know if he can even find the family of his mother. He doesn't know where Laban's house is going to be. He doesn't know whether they're going to receive him. He's now out there on his own, where he's always dwelt in that secure family environment. Now he's out there alone. Uncertainty, loneliness. And when that happens to us, brothers and sisters, we feel apprehensive and fearful. Was the blessing all worth it? If this was the cost of getting this blessing that he'd so sought after. Now he's out there in the freezing cold at night. Lost all the comforts of home in fear of his life. Was the blessing of God, was the blessing of Abraham really worth all this? Where is the God of Abraham? That's what he wanted to find. That was the thing that was burning in his mind. How could he be sure these promises were so true? He hadn't ever seen an angel. He hadn't ever had any manifestation from God. You know, brothers and sisters, we go through exactly the experience of Jacob at times in our lives, where we meet uncertainties and we don't know which way to go. And we wonder whether God is really there. And why? Why am I doing this? And why is this all happening to me? And is it all worth it? Well, it was in that frame of mind that night, probably on the end of two hard days, maybe three hard days, towards the evening, that he stumbled into the region of Bethel and finally finds what he's looking for, called in the record here, the place. And he's so exhausted. This place was on the top of a mountain. So here he is up on the top of a mountain and he's exhausted and he lays down with his head on a stone. That's how tired he was. And he goes to sleep. So come back to chapter 28 and verse 12. And he dreamed, and behold, a ladder set up on the earth, and the top of it reached to heaven, and behold, the angels of God ascending and descending upon it. And behold, Yahweh stood above it and said, I am Yahweh, the God of Abraham, thy father, God of Isaac, etc. Now, if we read that record like that, we just destroy it. You know how it should be read? Somewhat more like this. And he dreamed. And behold, a ladder was set up on the earth, and the top of it reached to heaven. And behold, the angels of God ascending and descending on it. And behold, Yahweh stood above it and said, three times there's this word, behold, in there, which is trying to catch the reader's attention to say, there's something here that's just so amazing. Take notice of this. And then another thing, and then another thing, building on top of this. This was just unbelievable experience that Jacob was going through that night as he lay down upon that rock that night. As you are well aware, the word ladder is not a very good translation. In fact, it's the only occurrence of the Hebrew word. So the translators have obviously had a bit of difficulty trying to translate it because they couldn't compare other places in the scriptures where it occurred. It just comes from a root word meaning to cast up, to exalt, or to raise up. So it clearly has the idea of some structure that was ascending, probably more like a staircase, or some big structure that was going up. And I don't think for a moment it looked anything like a ladder, but how big it was, we don't really know. I suspect that it was actually much bigger than we might get the impression of if we see little pictures that have been drawn in books, that this was a massive ascending structure that went right out of sight through the clouds up to heaven. Because that's how it's described here. And when it says here that it was, find the phrase, this ladder set up on the earth, Rotherham says that it was planted earthward. Now, think about what that means, because that's the literal Hebrew. It was planted earthward. If something is planted earthward, that is towards the earth, it's clearly implying that its origin is heavenly or is from God. So if you just saw a great structure on the ground and it went into heaven and that's all you saw, you would never know where it came from. You would never know whether someone started building that from the bottom upwards and built it to heaven or whether it had come down from heaven, but we're told where it came from. We're left in no doubt that this structure had nothing to do with human might. It was not built by man like the Tower of Babel. Interestingly, there's some amazing contrasts with the Tower of Babel, because the Tower of Babel was an effort of men to try and reach heaven. Whereas here, God is taking something and planting this downwards onto the earth. So it's touching the earth because God has put it there. And not only that, it's touching the very place where his head is laying. It comes right down to the very rock he's laying on, to this presumably one of these stones that was part of the altar at some stage. And there, the top goes right up into heaven, and the angels of God are ascending, which is important, ascending and descending. And so what we know is that these angels were already on the ground. Because if they are ascending and descending, they're starting here, going up to heaven and coming back again. So even though the origin of the structure is from heaven, the angels are here. And all of those little details are actually quite important in this whole story. And it then says, and Yahweh stood above it. Again, not a very accurate translation. The RSV says, Yahweh standing by. Rotherham, Yahweh was standing by him. It's just a word that means to stand up or to set up. And it's actually saying that the Yahweh angel was actually standing alongside Jacob, not at the top of the ladder. It's not talking about the father who was at the top of the ladder. It's talking about God's representative who was standing right there at the foot of the ladder, standing by him. And it may well be the same angel that occurs throughout Jacob's life, and we're going to meet that angel again in a couple of other contexts a little later through our studies. What's the significance of this in its immediate context? You know, it's quite fascinating, brothers and sisters, that the whole region of Bethel looks like a staircase. Now, that's not a particularly clear photograph. It's an aerial photograph around Bethel. And it actually, the whole region around Bethel is made of these limestone steps, like a staircase. Now, you take Jacob, who's coming into that region in late afternoon, and he's tired and weary, looking over his shoulder to see if Esau's coming all the time. And all he's trying to do is find this place, and he knows that it's at the top of a mountain. That's all he knows. He doesn't know which mountain. So what has he got to do? He's got to go to the top of every mountain and to the top of another one until he finds it. He's got to try and work out, ask people, but they don't even know. But he's got to climb up those staircases. And he's climbing up this just like a staircase. So here he is climbing up this thing, trying to get to the top. And eventually, we find, after all of that, he gets to the top. He's so exhausted. He's found what he wants and he lays down. And that very moment, God says, you're not at the top. Because what he sees is a massive staircase keeping on going. So here he's been struggling in his own might to climb up all of this, lays down exhausted, and he sees this new staircase going up further. And what? Is anyone tired? These angels of God are effortlessly moving up and down. All over the place. And here he is absolutely exhausted. And this great staircase is linking heaven to earth. So Jacob, even though he thought he'd got to the top of this mountain, Jacob, you are not at the top. You've struggled and it's all in your might to get to the top of this. But Jacob, when he laid down that night and put his head on that pillow, he must have felt very alone. But now, as soon as that vision emerged, he finds there's an innumerable company of angels all around him and going up to God effortlessly and back again. He must have laid his head down that night in weakness and afraid, wondering whether Esau might come across him at night, only to find that Yahweh is standing alongside of him. The angels were starting where he was. The angels were not coming down from heaven and going back to heaven. They were already there. As Paul, quoting the Old Testament, says in Hebrews, are they not sent forth to minister on behalf of those who shall be the heirs of salvation? And what Jacob had possibly temporarily forgot or needed reminding of is that all those angels were there all the time. Though he felt apprehensive, afraid, and alone, God was telling him, Jacob, those angels are all there, all around you, and I've sent my special angel to stand alongside you. And all the other angels are ministering on your behalf. They're there already. When he pulled back the curtain, allowed him to see it, he didn't have to send thousands of angels down from heaven. They were already there, ministering on behalf of him. And there in that desolate place, on the top of a mountain, in that lonely hill, he finds that he's in the house of God. Absolutely amazing. And what Jacob saw that night was the realities that he'd never seen so clearly before. That all this angelic activity was actually for him. And that God had put that all into place to protect him and to lead him, to guide him. You know, brothers and sisters, for Jacob, that was a life-changing vision. It lasted for the rest of his life. And though there were times when still he wavered and through the circumstances and pressures that came upon him, he temporarily forgot, he always came back to, and we find him never losing sight of that big picture, of that vision that he had at Bethel. Bethel becomes, for Jacob, brothers and sisters, the point at which there was this life-changing revelation. Because God was telling him, Jacob, your life is not just a series of rolling, indiscriminate, unconnected and insignificant events. Everything was being superintended by God's angels and guided by his influence. And here was a vision that was intended to transform him. It was to tell him, Jacob, God is real. I'm there and my angels are there. I'm interested in everything you do. And I've put my own representative angel alongside you that's controlling all these hosts for your good. Jacob, do you understand? You don't have to resort to the hands of Esau. How would he have felt that day? No, brothers and sisters, what Jacob saw that night in a vision was more than a vision. There was a dream he saw, but his actual reality, it was the reality of the circumstance. And God just for a moment drew back the curtain and allowed him to see what was really happening around him. Now, you and I, brothers and sisters, and Jacob, the rest of his life, could only ever see that by faith. He could only ever see that by conjuring it in his mind and remembering all that God had said and done and bringing back that vision that he'd had before and remembering that God would never leave him and he was always standing alongside him. But you know, brothers and sisters, absolutely no different for any of us. No different. And if you think about that vision, that is absolutely life-changing. If, brothers and sisters, we go through life and tomorrow, you just try this. And as you go to bed tonight, and the next day, and the next day, you just remember and try and consciously bring to your mind that the Yahweh angel is always standing alongside. And around him and at his discretion are all the myriad of hosts of the angels who are going up and down from heaven and back again and are ministering all and orchestrating all the circumstances around us in our life. If we could actually see that, brothers and sisters, every moment of our life, what would change? What would change in your life? Anything? Well, perhaps it might remove some of the fear and anxiety we have at times. Certainly remove some of Jacob's that night. It may give us a great deal of confidence and assurance in the hope that we've put our feet to. It may constrain us and pull us away from temptation and sin. But whatever happens, brothers and sisters, our lives would be different if we saw that vision every day. Well, Jacob was only given it then, and it went. Because God was teaching him, Jacob, you've got to generate that by faith. That is the reality now, but it's only going to be by faith. Now, that vision, brothers and sisters, was not just something given for his assurance on that night. It was for his assurance in the immediate circumstance. There's no question about that. But we know that Jesus comments on it. Let's go to John 1. Because here, Jesus makes reference to this in a very interesting context. John 1. We know that Philip finds Nathanael, verse 45. Nathanael means the gift of God. And he wants to bring him to Jesus. He said, come and see Jesus. And Nathanael was astute enough to say that, no, the Messiah is not going to come out of Nazareth. But Philip, though he couldn't answer him, said, well, look, come and see. Just come and see. I can't answer your questions. You just come and see for yourself. So this man was clearly a fairly astute and godly man. Verse 46, and Nathanael said to him, can any good thing come out of Nazareth? So he knew his Bible. He knew what he was looking for, and was obviously waiting for Messiah. Verse 47, and Jesus saw Nathanael coming to him and said unto him, behold, an Israelite indeed, in whom is no guile. An Israelite indeed, in whom is no guile. You know that phrase, no guile, in the Greek is exactly the same phrase that's translated subtlety used of Jacob back in Genesis 27, verse 35. My brother came with subtlety and took away the birthright. So what's Jesus saying? Behold, an Israelite indeed, in whom is no Jacob, in effect. So there's a play here on the characteristics and the names of Jacob here, Jacob and Israel. Behold, an Israelite indeed. Now, that's a strange thing for Jesus to say. Why did he actually say that? It appears that Jesus had actually read his mind. And he'd been thinking about Jacob's experiences in Bethel. And Nathan is amazed. Nathanael is amazed in verse 48. And Nathanael said unto him, whence knowest thou me? And Jesus answered and said unto him, before that Philip called thee, when thou wast under the fig tree, I saw thee. Well, what did it matter whether he's under a fig tree or what? What's that got to do with it? Who cares where he was? But it was enough to convince Nathanael that this was Messiah. Verse 49. Nathanael answered and said to him, Rabbi, thou art the Son of God. Thou art the King of Israel. Why was he so effusive here, just from this first encounter with Jesus? Well, he was convinced that this man was Messiah because the very first thing that man did as he walked up to him, he knew what he was thinking. He knew that he'd been thinking about Jacob under the fig tree. And not only that, when he says, well, how do you know me? He says, well, I saw you when you're on the fig tree. The fig tree was evidently a long way away, and he couldn't actually literally see. So he knew he was under a fig tree. And as far as Nathanael was concerned, if a man can read his thoughts, if a man can understand where he is and what he's thinking, this man is from God. And he therefore comes out with this great confession about him being the Son of God and the King of Israel. And Jesus goes on in verse 50 and says, because I said unto thee, I saw you under the fig tree, do you believe? Thou shalt see greater things than these, Nathanael. This is not where it's stopping. And he said unto me, verily, verily, I say unto you, hereafter you shall see the heaven open and the angels of God ascending and descending upon the Son of Man. So Jesus now picks up exactly what Nathanael had been thinking about, meditating under his fig tree. He had evidently been trying to piece this all together and thinking about the significance of the vision at Bethel, and now Jesus just lifts it out. You think it's amazing that you're calling me Messiah just because I knew where you were and what you were thinking. You're going to see much greater things than that. In fact, the word there in verse 51, hereafter, in the Greek is just the word now. Now you'll see heaven open and the angels of God ascending and descending on the Son of Man. Now, the most translations actually change that phrase the angels of God ascending and descending upon the Son of Man. The word upon there really probably is better in the context translated as unto. He would see, now you shall see the Son of the heaven open and the angels of God ascending and descending unto the Son of Man. So what in fact was Jesus saying? He was saying that through the work of Jesus, heaven was going to be open. And there was always going to be this great staircase that had come from heaven to earthward. And it would remain open continuously as a link between God and men. But Jesus himself was to replace the Yahweh angel. It says there that you shall see the angels of God ascending and descending unto. They were ascending and descending unto the Son of Man. Now the Son of Man would be standing right alongside Nathanael. That's what he's really saying. That's what you're going to see. This was a promise from Jesus to say that he was going to always be with them through the guiding ministration of their angels. You know, when Jesus left them, what did he say to his disciples? This is a promise that he made in so many words in Matthew 28. He said, "Lo, I am with you always, even unto the end of the age." So it's as if in this figure of the ladder, the staircase that Jacob saw, that Jesus now appropriates that to a much wider context and says, all of those who are godly are going to have access to the host of the angels, and Christ himself as the superintendent of all of their activity will be able to be standing alongside of us. You know, that's a terribly difficult thing to really comprehend, isn't it, brothers and sisters? We can understand just in words what that means and get a picture of this great staircase of Christ standing alongside us at all times and the angels ascending and descending. But you know, there's only one thing that's going to make that a reality. For us, we can walk out of here and think about it tomorrow and then never again, or it's just going to be complete and it's not going to have any impact on our life unless we are a Nathanael. Now, the one thing that Nathanael was picked up for was because he was under his fig tree. And he was thinking about that circumstance back there. Do you know this phrase, sitting under the fig tree, occurs a few times. But there's a couple of very significant ones. Perhaps we'll quickly look at one. One that you'll know very, very well. Micah chapter 4. This probably immediately jumped back into your mind anyway. You think, what on earth has this got to do with anything? I mean, this is a future application. Micah 4, we know it's about the time when the kingdom's set up. It's come to pass in the last days, verse 1. The mountain of the house of Yahweh shall be established in the top of the mountains. Ah, that's interesting. Mountains. And all peoples are going to flow unto it. And nations are going to come and they're going to say, go up to the Mount of Yahweh, to the house of who? What? The house of the God of Jacob? The Beth-El of Jacob? That's where they're going to go, brothers and sisters. Is that significant or not? Just wait and see if it is. Because people are going to ascend up to the Bethel of Jacob. They're going to follow the same path that Jacob went to find God at Bethel. And he will teach us of his ways and he will walk in his paths, and the law shall go forth from Zion, the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. Because that's exactly what Jacob learned up there. But not only that, if we read on, and he shall judge among many nations and shall rebuke strong nations afar off, and they shall beat their swords into plowshares. You know what that's saying, brethren and sisters? What God is going to do as a result of establishing something in the top of the mountain for people to ascend up to and come to grips with, what's going to happen is that the nations are going to stop their own schemings. That's what verse 3 is saying. They're going to stop resorting to their own arms and their own ways of sorting things out. This is the very issue of Jacob's life, which is why Jacob's embedded right through this little prophecy of the future. So they're going to not beat their plows, their swords into plowshares, and or they're going to, and their spears into pruning crooks again, because they're not going to learn war anymore. Verse 4, but they shall sit every man under his vine, under his fig tree. And you know what? Mostly, and for years and years, I read that to say, oh yes, and it's all going to be very nice. Everyone's going to just relax and have a lovely time. It's going to be prosperity. But look at the context. But they shall sit under their vine and fig tree. What on earth is sitting under your vine and fig tree got to do with verse 3? Because God's just been saying they're going to stop relying in themselves. They're going to stop relying in themselves. They're going to learn to trust me. They're going to get rid of all their implements and stop doing all things themselves. And what they're going to do in its place, they shall sit every man under his vine and fig tree, and none will make him afraid. Is none going to make them afraid, brothers and sisters, just because they happen to go and sit under a fig tree? Doesn't make sense. The reason none's going to make them afraid is because of what is happening under that fig tree. Because sitting under the vine and fig tree, under the blessing of God, is a symbol of quiet, thoughtful meditation. And the reason men are not going to trust in themselves is because they've climbed up that hill to the God of Bethel. They've actually understood it. They're going to go back under their vine and fig tree where it's quiet, where it's away from everything else, where it's peaceful and only God's things are around. And they're going to actually think about what that really, really means in their life. And then none's going to make them afraid. When they've come to grips with that vision, when they've actually thought and meditated about that to the point that they really understand what that means, none shall make them afraid. Well, unless we become Nathaniels, brethren and sisters, we're never ever going to find the consolation that Jacob was to find that night. And if Jacob just went his way, never thought about that again, that night would have been a waste of time. You know, we're in the midst of just absolutely chaotic, stupid lives where everything just is going hither and thither, and almost things seem out of control. There's never time to do anything. You know, brothers and sisters, we actually have to find and make some hard decisions to sort out the real issues of life and find time to get under our vine and fig tree. Because we won't find the consolation that God was giving to Jacob that night in Bethel unless we do. And he left him. Let's just come back there and conclude tonight now. He left him with this marvellous assurance of a personal guidance and protection. So back in verse 15 of chapter 28 there, these incredible words were added to the blessing, because he just reiterated the Abrahamic covenant in verses 13 and 14. He says, behold, I am with you, Jacob, and will keep you in all places whither you go, and I'll bring you again unto this land, for I will not leave you until I have done that which I have spoken to thee of. What had he spoken to him of? He'd spoken of making him a great nation, of bringing him and giving him an eternal inheritance. So until the probation of his life was completed and he was perfected, God would never leave him. And then, of course, God was never going to leave him either. You know, those words here to Jacob, which were not just abstract things. Now the promises have real personal hope for him. And this little phrase in verse 15, I will not leave thee. I will not leave thee. Becomes the basis of many exhortations to follow. It's a very interesting thing. If you've never actually done this little exercise, brothers and sisters and young people, it's worthwhile. Get a concordance and follow it. Because we find it came back to Israel, that exhortation, to Joshua, to Solomon, to Jeremiah, to all the disciples, and finally on to all the saints in Hebrews chapter 13. And the context of all those is interesting. Because God's consistently made this same promise to others. So this is not something that just happened to Jacob. This promise has been offered to us as well. But for Jacob, it marked the very beginning of his typical probation. This was to mark the beginning of God working in his life. Of course, God was working with him before, but there's a typical period of 40 years in Jacob's life that starts at Bethel and comes back to Bethel. And in that period, God's working through him. And at the start of that, God reveals his promises and gives him a guarantee of guidance and protection, and then says, "Jacob, off you go." And he didn't see the angels again. Not during that period. Not until right at the very end. Because he had to learn by faith to struggle through. To learn not to trust in his own scheming. Though he tried at times to do that, to bring his pilgrimage to an end, God said, "No. That pilgrimage will come to an end when I've done what I promised or have spoken unto you of." And that's one of the frustrations that Jacob found, and what we find, brethren and sisters, that God's in control, not us. We might have assumed that Jacob's life, as a result of this great vision that he had on that night, would be a life of unmixed prosperity and happiness. But as Brother Robert Roberts said, "A God-favoured and God-kept man is not a man who suffers no evils, feels no anxieties, and resorts to no expedients." So we find him in the ups and downs of life from this point. And through it all, he's to learn the greatest lesson of his life. There are many Jacobs in the service of God today. Men who have received clear and gracious divine assurances of the forgiveness of sins, of unfailing heavenly care and guidance, and of ceaseless angelic concern for all their affairs, like you and I. And yet who live as though convinced that by their own wit and wisdom and scheming and contriving worth more than anything the heavenly minister can achieve. It is enough to make angels weep with disappointment. Think about those words, brothers and sisters. Yet happily, with some, the day of realization comes early enough, as it did with Jacob, to transform a life of assertive self-dependence into a pilgrimage of faith. And here we find, typically, this pilgrimage of faith beginning in Jacob's life. We're going to follow him in our next study, right into the heart of those difficult times. But here, Jacob's immediate response, and it shows how godly a man he was. He was awed by this whole experience. He was fearful by it, because he now says, "I've seen Yahweh in this place and I knew it not." He hadn't realized that God was so close. He didn't realize that God had actually come so close to his life, brethren and sisters. And that's how we feel sometimes. You know, it's easy to acknowledge that God will be standing alongside us, that his ministers are all around us. But it's a very challenging thing to live life as if that's the truth. You know what Jacob said? "Even in this place is the house of God." And that's the challenge we find. Even in this place, we can understand that the house of God can be somewhere. And that there are times when we can find sanctity and peace of mind in the house of God. But what Jacob was to realize, the house of God was wherever he was. And so what did he do? He rose up early that next morning and he did two things. He set up a pillar and poured it with oil, and he made a vow. He wasn't told to do that, brothers and sisters. That's the response of this godly man. And you know, brothers and sisters, tonight we've seen the same vision as he saw. What's our response? You know why he set up a pillar? He wanted to do something so that he would never, never forget. That's what he set up a pillar. He did something so that he erected that and put it in a place so that it would never move and he'd always be reminded. You know, we can do things like that in our lives if we want to. Mentally, physically, we can put things on our walls, on our desks. We can actually do things to try and keep our minds back on there. That's what Jacob wanted to do. He wasn't told to do that, but it was his great desire to do that. And the other thing he did is he made a vow. Verse 20. Jacob vowed a vow and said, God be with me and will keep me in the way that I go and will give me bread to eat and raiment to put on so that I come again to my father's house in peace, then shall Yahweh be my God. You know, brothers and sisters, that reads as though he is making a bargain. He wasn't making a bargain at all. Young's literal says, seeing that God is with me, this is what's going to happen. So he was believing it. Seeing that God is with me, I will and will keep me in all the way that I'll go and give me bread to eat and raiment. The promise of God he was absolutely prepared to accept. And he said, because God is with me, he is going to be my God. And he determined from that point that he was. You know, he gave a tenth. No one told him to. Gave a tenth of all that he had. How he did it, we don't know. But it was an evidence of this great spirit of a very faithful man who now, though fleeing for his life through his own stupidity, his own folly, trying to deceive his father, and now he finds he's out of the house and he's running and God picks him up along the way, gives him this marvelous assurance, reiterates the promises, and now we find that man responding by wanting to keep God right at the center of his life all his days and wanting to give everything he's got as a token that God owns everything. That's a very wonderful picture, brothers and sisters. Sometimes we get the wrong end of the picture of Jacob. Jacob is a mighty, mighty man of faith. And he goes off, and we're going to meet him as he arrives in Haran on our next study and find all the way that God took him through there.